Today's Teisho will be on page 30 in the Book of Serenity, Dasui's Aeonic Fire. Introduction, obliterating all oppositions, cutting off both sides, smashing the mass of doubt. How does that require a single phrase? The capital is not an inch of a step away. The greatest mountain only weighs 3 pounds. But tell me, based on what order can you dare to speak this way? Case. A monk asked Dasui, when the fire at the end of an aeon ravages through and the whole world is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? Dasui said, destroyed. The monk said, then it goes along with it? Dasui said, it goes along with it. A monk asked Longji, when the fire ending the aeon rages through and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? Longji said, not destroyed. The monk said, why is it not destroyed? Longji said, because it is the same as the universe. Verse, destroyed, not destroyed. Going along with that, the billion world universe. In their phrases, after all, there's no hook and chain action. Their feet are much obstructed by entangling vines. Do you understand or not? For a matter which is distinctly clear, punctiliousness is extreme. Those who know the heart bring it forth. Don't haggle. You'll lose me buying and selling at the market. Well, I want to thank everybody for doing an excellent job this morning, and it's been pure pleasure so far. It's just been a real joy. Everybody's been doing wonderful work, and people have been coming into Dokusan presentations that show really deep practice. Really, it's quite wonderful, you know. Somebody came in the Dokusan room today and gave a wordless answer that was really excellent. It actually made me feel wonderful. It's like, what a lovely present. Everybody's doing an excellent job. People are really surprising me, you know. It's like, you know, they come in and say things like, wow, that's great. So, very good work. Really great. I am like a, you know, a little bit, first of all, the teacher is not me, the teacher is Zen. And Zen practice. And my job is like to help in the process. So I don't make things happen. All I can do is try to facilitate, you know, to try to help things along. And I often think it's like being a farmer, you know. You can plant the seeds, but you can't make them grow, you know. It takes the whole universe to make something grow. So you can put the seed in the ground carefully, and you can, you know, but, you know, if there's no rain, then nothing's going to come up. Or if there's too much rain, you know, that'll start to come up and get soggy and maybe get a disease or whatever. And, you know, so the farmer, if you want to go crazy, if you want to be a farmer and you want to go crazy, you can get up every day and worry, right? You can go out and look at the, are they coming up? Not yet. Oh, look at the sky. No rain. And I do think a lot of farmers live that way. It's like, you know, it's like they worry, you know, if there's no rain. And then if it's raining, they worry there might be too much rain. And indeed, you know, too little is bad, too much is bad. So even though we might think of farmers as having an easy life, the truth is that not only is it physically hard, but it must be psychologically challenging. You know, you just have to get out of the way. I think that being a teacher is like that too. You just have to get out of the way and try to encourage people to make an effort. And the process has this wonderful quality, the wonderful power to help people wake up. So anyway, I feel like I'm delighted as a farmer to come out of the house and notice that a beautiful rain has fallen and everything is coming up, and it's beautiful, right? Beautiful. Today's teisho, as usual, the beauty of these teishos is that they make absolutely, beauty of these koans is that they make absolutely no sense at all, right? It's like, let me explain it a little bit. Indian mythology and Buddhist mythology, there are world successive, actually an infinite number of successive world ages called kalpas. And the universe is understood to be eternal, actually. A universe arises just like a moment, and it arises out of nothing, as a matter of fact. And then it comes into its full form, and then eventually it starts to deteriorate, and then it goes away. It's destroyed. And then another universe arises. It sounds familiar, doesn't it? If you sit on your cushion and you watch the moment, you'll notice the moment comes out of mushin, right? And then it goes. And then it comes, and then it goes. Well, Indian people have been doing a lot of meditation for a long time, and they figured, well, everything is probably like this, you know, including the universe. And indeed, you know, actually physicists have suggested this is true now. A lot of people don't think there is such a thing as the Big Bang. They think that there's been an infinite number of Big Bangs in the cosmos. And that people think now that black holes are like incubation for a universe, right, or universes. So a black hole produces a universe, and that universes actually contain black holes that produce universes. I don't know. The idea is that at the end of a kalpa, there'll be a fire. Everything will be destroyed by fire. And everything will be burned up in the fire. So a monk asked Da Sui, when the fire at the end of a kalpa rages through and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? Now, by this he means, when you're in it, when you're really in deep samadhi, you feel like you're in it, you know? It might feel like you're down in the bottom of an ocean, or it might feel like you're made out of spider webs. You know, people experience it in different ways, but when you're in very deep samadhi, you might feel like you have almost no body, and it's different, experienced in different ways for different people, but this state is quite wonderful, you know. And so basically this is a monk who's had a deep meditation experience. He's really been practicing, and he's entered deep samadhi, and he says to Dasui, Master Dasui, you know, when this world is destroyed by fire, is this surely this can't be destroyed? And Dasui said, no, it's destroyed too. Right? So the monk can't believe it. He says, what? Even that's destroyed? Dasui says, oh, it all goes together. So that's story number one. Now, then there's another monk, maybe a million years from now, on another universe, who asked Longji, when the fire ending the kalpa, rages through and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? Longji said, this master says, no, it's not destroyed. And the monk says, why is it not destroyed? And Longji said, because it is the same as the universe. But, you know. So, you know, please don't try to figure this out, you know, with your discriminating mind. But the point is that you have a question about what can be destroyed and what can't be destroyed. And you have two different teachers who give totally different answers. And this is something you might have noticed before. So, for example, a monk asked Master Nansen, what is Buddha? And he said, mind is Buddha. And then on another occasion, somebody asked him, what is Buddha? And he said, it's not mind, basically. So it looks like a contradiction, but please don't be deceived by intellectual contradictions. So basically, some of you are working with the breath perception koan, and you're doing a wonderful job. I must say that I'm really astonished at the beginners here who are sitting so well. By the time I was in, second day of Sesshin, I think I could barely walk. And when people came into Dokusan last night, they were new people. We're doing so well. I was just so impressed, and frankly, I was a little envious, you know, because I was such a wreck at the same time on my first sesshin. You're watching your breath, and I'm sure it's challenging. You know, use your breath to sweep away your pain. The pain, you know, the positive thing about pain is that it does really cut through all the baloney, you know. Normally, people live in a kind of a fantasy world. You know, we prefer not to necessarily, because life hurts us, you know, in various ways, we learn how to, like, secrete fantasy around things, you know. So, you know, basically, let's say, you meet a person and you want to go out on a date with that person. Well, you know, you might see the person in school and think, maybe you have you say, hello, how are you? And the person says, you know, good, thank you. And you might walk away thinking, I think she really likes me. Yeah. She didn't just say good. She said, good, how are you? So she's interested in me. You know? Yeah. So you go home and it's like, I think she's very interested in me, you know? We might have a lot in common. You know, we're both in French class. She's interested in French. I'm interested in French, you know? And pretty soon, you know, you know, you're in Hawaii on your honeymoon, you know, basically, right? Okay. Yeah, isn't that how it works? You know? Okay. So then you go to French class next time, and you see her, and you know, basically, you start having a conversation, and you might say, "Do you like so? Are you interested in French writers?" And she might say yes, and then you might say, "Well, you know, do you like Albert Camus or something like that?" And she might say, "No, I really don't like existentialism, you know." And then you might say, "Oh well, you know, would you like to go out for a cup of coffee?" And maybe she says no. You know? So then you go home and you think, you know, she was really a very shallow person. Very shallow, you know. And this is a protection, right? You know, it's protection. So, you know, she's obviously, you know, blind to my excellent qualities, you know, this kind of thing. And of course, you know, it never works totally, because of course it is rejection, and then but you know, that makes us cling more desperately to the stories we want to tell, you know. So this is how people normally live, and it actually creates, it's designed to help us, but it actually in the long run doesn't help us that much, because we sort of become a very fearful people, and we become prisoners of our illusions. And you can see people who are very deeply unhappy because of this, especially if they're around my age, after you've had a chance to steep in your illusions for 30 years, you can be very fearful and very brittle and unhappy. So, basically, one of the good things about sashin is that when you come here and you sit on the cushion and you encounter pain, it's a very elemental, crude experience. You know, it's just the crudest thing in the world, right? Because you know, we don't get up at 8 o'clock and have coffee and then get in a circle and talk about the universe. You know. We don't say, well, you know, let's talk about it. Let's have a talk about identity today. You know, and we all share. Would you like to share? You know, and so on. Instead, we do something really crude, which is you sit on the cushion and you begin to have pain, right? And it's quite important. You know, the Buddha too, you know, he didn't start his career by saying, let's talk about reincarnation, shall we? Don't you think you might have been a king in your last life? You know, he starts by saying, you know what? The most basic element of life is pain. This is something, you know, not everybody wanted to hear then. But the basic element of human experience is pain. That's why I told the little story. That's why I decided that girl in French class wasn't really very deep. Because she rejected me, you know. So the pain, but I could say pain, that has nothing to do with it. I made an intellectual decision, you know. It was a judgment, a rational judgment. Right? But behind it, there's like this pain. So when you come to sashin and you sit down on the cushion, you know, there it is, there's this pain, and you can't bullshit your way around it. What we normally do is like secrete illusion around ourselves to protect us from pain, like an oyster secretes a shell, you know, actually. Humans are like oysters, you know, really. And they secrete a fantasy around themselves to protect themselves from uncertainty and pain. But when you come on to sashin and you sit on the cushion and you counter the pain, you try to turn on the fantasy machine, it doesn't work. It's like a little oyster that can't secrete any shell, you know, because the water keeps washing it away too fast. And then you have to be a different kind of creature. You can't live in your shell, you know. And that's a challenge, you know. But Zen is all about becoming like a kind of creature who doesn't need a shell, you know. And you learn how to swim in the ocean. You realize, well, maybe I'm not an oyster, you know. Maybe I'm a beautiful, sea bass, you know. Maybe I'm a creature of the ocean. Or maybe I'm a dolphin, you know, not an oyster. I'm trying to secrete. You know, so we can become a very different kind of creature, very much at ease in the world, if we begin to do this practice in an extended way. So you sit on the cushion, and you watch your breath, and the pain arises, and you can try to have a fantasy. You can say, okay, I'm in Hawaii, the waves are crashing, you know, but the pain just like eats that up, right? And you can't reason with it, there's nothing you can do on the cushion that will make it go away. You know, you could even, you know, try to make a deal with the devil. You know, you can say, okay, if you're there, you know, I'll sign my soul away, if you just make it, it won't go away. Every sick person knows this, you know. So basically, what you have to do is use your breath to sweep the pain away. And you squeeze your hara, your dantian, the region below your navel, and you sweep the pain away, and you sweep the pain away, and you sweep the pain away. And little by little, you begin to... your mind begins to find this calm place, this calm place. And this is very important because usually we do all kinds of crazy things. We live with all kinds of fantasies. And some of them are very destructive because we're afraid of pain, right? I never talked about this before. But my father was a soldier, and at the end of his life, my father confessed to my sister that when he was in Vietnam, he had killed people, like Abu Ghraib type situation. And he never told that to me. My sister told me a couple of years after my father died, you know what Dad said? And he said he was so... he thought he was going to hell, basically, for what he had done. And my father was like in the military, a branch of the military that, was in security. So I imagine that he did some really bad things in Vietnam. And when he came back from the war, he was drinking very heavily. And my parents got divorced. And he was like a tortured person. And I actually never understood this until my sister told me about these events, you know. And I was there when he died, but he didn't share this with me. Yeah. And I thought, why would he do that, you know? I realize now why my father was so tortured, you know. Because he was afraid of being this colossal failure. And letting down all these people he respected, and so he did terrible things, you know. I was just amazed, you know, when I put these pieces together, and I realized, you know, my dad was in Vietnam for 6 years, and it kind of destroyed him in a way. And when I thought, why would he do that? You know, why would he do something so out of character? You know, and no wonder it sort of ate him up. But it was because he was afraid of, you know, all his friends were saying, you know, this must be done. You know, it's like the fantasy, right? You know, it's fear of pain, not just pain, but fear of pain. You know, fear of pain. I think it's very, very important not to be afraid of pain. Because fear of pain, and pain will make you do, I think, if my own family is any indication, just terrible things. So you know, it's hard to be honest with ourselves or to be honest with others when our motive is a fear of pain. And when you sit in pain and you realize, I don't have to run from this, it's not going to destroy me. You know, I have special resources, and I can deal with this pain. I think this is enormously important. I think it's like enormously important. You will sooner or later, probably might not happen at this session, but sooner or later you're going to be going through a session where you have pain, you have pain, you have pain, and then all of a sudden, you know, you just don't have pain. And you're at this serene place, and basically your pain is like a whisper or like a murmur instead of somebody screaming in your ear, and you feel this like unshakable quality, you know. And this is very hard to reach, but I know many of you are there or have been there. And if you're just starting out, you'll get there, you know. But you think, you know, this pain is going to destroy me. But actually, you can go to a place where, you know, it's like indestructible, you know. Yeah. So often in our learning how to deal with this is very, very important. You know, so if you don't run from pain, you can have a whole different attitude towards life, I think. If you can't handle pain, you know, you're going to wind up, you know, my dad was kind of like, as it turns out, kind of like a monster. I didn't really know it. But, you know, I loved him, and we didn't always get along, and there was a lot of mysteries about my dad, you know. But when I found this out, it was like so many pieces. It was like, well, that was why he was drinking. That was why, you know, Mom and Dad broke up, and why they were arguing. He must have been like a tortured soul. You know, I never understood. You know, the beginning of a different kind of life is not being afraid of pain and running from pain. And I think it makes people capable of a kind of compassion that they don't always have, or narrowly, you know. Sometimes people can develop that compassion just from being in pain. Like, you know, one person I've always admired was President Roosevelt. And Roosevelt was a very rich guy who had every break in life. And then he got polio, and it was excruciatingly painful. And he could barely walk after it was over. You know, he always had leg braces and so on. And I remember reading, Winston Churchill, not somebody I particularly admire, but Winston Churchill wrote in one of his books, he said that he was staying at the White House with Roosevelt, and he was watching Roosevelt try to get into his wheelchair or from his bed, and he didn't want to be helped. He was struggling to get to hoist himself into his wheelchair. I guess that was it, and he kept failing, right? But he finally got into his wheelchair, and Roosevelt, Churchill, who was a pretty cruel person sometimes, said that his heart just melted. He thought, this is a person of extraordinary courage, you know, and of course he was also, Roosevelt was also a person of great compassion, you know, and when the country was in completely torn to pieces and had gone crashing down, you know, he was very, he had this great desire to help people who were disadvantaged and so on. And I think that the experience of pain, his ability to face it as a reality, made him such a good person. you know, eventually what will happen to you is that you will be able to get to this calm place, and then you will find that the calm place is also like very empty. It's like a, when you look at your mind, it's blank and dark. There's a kind of profound emptiness at the core of your being, actually. You know? And this is a wonderful experience. Usually when people can enter deep samadhi, deep concentration, the pain ceases, and you're in this state where you might not feel like your body is entirely present. It's like that out-of-body experience I was talking about, where you can still hear, and there's sort of some awareness, but it's as though inside large parts of your body have just disappeared. And you often, not always, but often this state, it can be very blissful, right? It's very beautiful, very blissful. It's a wonderful condition, but you know, actually I always have to point out to people that this is not enlightenment, you know. This state of bliss is beautiful. It's like, oh, I'm finally out of pain, right? Finally out of pain. And if you have a physical problem, this is like an extraordinary gift to be free from pain. It's just the most wonderful thing in the world, right? To be able to go into deep samadhi, deep mushin, and your deliverance from physical pain. You're still, if you get too attached to that state, you can cause yourself a new kind of pain, right, actually, because you wind up clinging to that that beautiful state, that which is also feels like very still and peaceful. You know? So when people are able to enter deep samadhi for the first time, it's really a great experience, you know. It's like no pain, bliss, beautiful. And people who want to practice the way of Zen have to be able to enter that state. But you know, if you try to stay there, you actually become a more fearful person, not a less fearful person, because it's like you want to be in that nice samadhi state, and you're afraid to step out of it because you might have to go back to the pain. See. And it's like, I just got out of that pain. Now you want me to go back into it. No. But if you stay with mushin long enough, you know, something happens that you need to be aware of. You know. At first, when people encounter mushin, they experience it as a they can experience it as wonderful because there's this relief from pain, or they can experience it as just a blankness, you know, like a dead blankness. And some people experience it as a frightening blankness. You know, so various people respond in various ways. Some people just say, "Wow, this is great." Some people say, it's like I'm dead, you know? This is a kind of practice that's called the dead wood Zen, you know? This was a big problem in Zen history, where a lot of monks would get to this state where they would just be like a piece of dead wood, and they'd just be in this blankness. And they felt, well, I'm out of pain, everything's gone, great, you know? And that was a mistake, you know. Some people experience mu as like wonderful painlessness, which is wonderful. Some people experience it as dead blankness, which is a mistake. And some people are actually afraid of it. They're like a little distrustful, like, you know, what am I getting myself in here? And indeed, I I have had people in our group, we've had people who are, at first they're very uneasy with this blankness. It's like you're going into the Pacific Ocean and it's midnight and you can't tell the water from the blankness, you know? And you're afraid like a shark is going to grab you or something. So there's like a very uneasy, these are different responses. But if you stay in a mushin long enough, you're going to have a wonderful experience because it doesn't stay as a dead blankness. It doesn't stay as a stillness, simply an empty stillness. It has a kind of dynamic character. One of the interesting things about mushin is that it's not just a dead blank stillness. It's very lively. It's very, energizing. When I get up in the morning and I sit sometimes, look, this is the truth. Sometimes I get on the cushion. I sit down on the cushion and I feel like a bomb is going off, of energy. It's like, there's energy welling up, like boom, It's so sweet, it doesn't happen every time, But every once in a while I sit down on the cushion and it's just like, it's like a nuclear explosion of life energy. And it's incredible and it's great, And a lot of Zen practice is learning to embrace that energy, is learning to embrace, see, if we cling to stillness, and if we're in a lot of pain or uncertainty, or if we're, that we want a haven, right? We want a safe haven. But if you go deeper into mushin, it has this tremendous dynamism, this tremendous energy, energy. If Zen was just about sitting on the cushion and just getting into stillness and bliss, then basically that would be a very limiting practice. And the Buddha said that's not enlightenment. Your world would still be. In fact, if you cling to bliss, if you come to sesshin, and you love that peaceful stillness, let's face it. If you're coming out of hell, that peaceful stillness is wonderful. But if you cling to that peaceful stillness, when you leave sesshin, you go back into hell again. You go back. It's hell again. So there's another way to live. When you sit in deep mushin long enough, you begin to experience like a kind of energy, the deeper you go into move, more energy. You might wonder what we're doing with the calling of mu. Those of you who are new here have heard people screaming in the other room. Right? Pay no attention to the screams you hear in the other room. Nothing is happening. Don't worry. It's all okay. It seems like such a crazy thing to do is to come in and call mu. But I'm. The idea is to open yourself to that energy, open yourself to that primordial life energy. And of course, we have a hard time doing so because so many reasons, right? We don't want to lose our bliss. Another one is that we might be afraid of pain. Another one is that that we don't trust, you know, it's hard to surrender yourself to something that seems, you know, you don't know, you know. And it, to give yourself to this energy is, you know, it's like, what is this, you know? And so we hold back. There's like a deep instinctual holding back, you know. There's other reasons too, you know. There's self-consciousness. You know, you go in and you think, oh God, what an asshole I am, you know, or I'll never be able to do this, you know, or I'm a loser, I can't do this, you know. There's a million different, you know, or we're, you know, you try to make it, I'll make it happen, you know, I'll go in there and I'll, you know, and what comes out of your mouth is like often, you know, pathetic. You say, I'll knock him over out. You know, this pathetic little move, you know. So you can't make it happen. You have to go into deep mushin, and then you have to, you have to open yourself to that energy, yeah? And like any other, you can, sometimes you're in the flow and sometimes you're not in the flow, you know? But if you, you know, you don't know until you try. See, it's you have to make yourself an instrument of that energy. I think this is a beautiful way to live, is to make yourself an instrument of that energy. Mahakashapa, the Buddhist student, his name was Kashapa, you could translate as drinker of light. It's like drinker of energy. This is like better than Red Bull, you know. This is like, this is a primordial energy. And Kashapa was drinker of energy, yeah. And so you can be like a drinker of energy. And you can harmonize yourself with the energy of life itself, of the universe, you know. And you just have to keep at it, you know. And then you know, as you're facing life's challenges, you have a different, you encounter life in a different way, you know. Instead of living out of your head, you know, and instead of saying, well, what will please X, what will please him and please her and please blah blah blah, you know, they expect me to do this, I should do that, and what shall I do? Shall I east or west, north or south, east or west, north or south? You enter deep mushin and you harmonize yourself with that energy, and you let the energy guide you in life. You know, this is why the mukhon is really inexhaustible. So we, you know, let's harmonize ourselves with the deep mushin, and drink and bathe ourselves. Really, I mean, this morning was just like, you know, let's bathe ourselves in that beautiful energy and in that beautiful, sacred, timeless energy, which is so wonderful and indestructible. And ageless, you know. Let's just do it. And then, you know, koan training is learning how to use that energy to see, to experience the world fearlessly. You know, it takes a little time. Little by little, you know, the more you live in that energy, the more purifying it is. And the more open you can be and more truthful. And the less you feel the need to secrete a fantasy around yourself. And, you know, eventually you'll come into the Dokusan room and say things or do things that are quite unusual, you know. I mean, you might say something to me that if the average person heard it would say, what? That doesn't make me... But, you know, it's real. You know, I know exactly what you're talking about. This is called not living in the world of fantasy. But going back to immediate experience, things as they actually unfold from moment to moment. It takes great clarity, great mental stability, and great energy. So, Let's bathe in this beautiful energy. We all have fears. We all have obstacles, you know. But every time we go back into that ocean, you know, we're purifying our body, hearts, and minds. And every time we're changed a little bit, we get a little, become a little more Buddhas, yeah, a little more Buddha. A monk asked Dai Sui, when the fire at the end of the kalpa rages through and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? It's like, I'm so afraid of being destroyed. You know, I'm so afraid of being destroyed. Quick, turn on the illusion machine, right? And Dai Sui says, okay, well, you're able to enter samadhi, but you're still clinging, you're still afraid. You know? So he says the worst thing, destroyed. You know, the worst thing that you can possibly, we think, if I don't get that job, I'm going to be destroyed. You know, if my book gets rejected, I'll be destroyed. If she doesn't go out on a date with me, destroyed. You know, see, that's human thinking. Right? But please bathe yourself in mushini. You know, bathe yourself in mushini. And monks incredulous, oh my God, don't tell me. Maybe Dasu's playing a little game with him. But then he goes back to the cushion, yeah, hopefully he goes back into deep mushin. And a monk asked Longji, when the fire ending the kalpa rages through the whole universe, is it going to be destroyed or not? And Longji says, no, don't worry. Now go back to the moon. Bathe in this beauty. Both answers are right, you know.